As part of healing the wounds of war, Vietnamese victims of Agent Orange are coming to share their experiences at Portland State University's Multicultural Center, Room 228 in Smith Memorial Student Union. Share their experiences, build solidarity, and help achieve justice for these Vietnamese Agent Orange victims. The event takes place from 7 to 10 p.m. on December 7th. For more information, visit vn-agentorange.org. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of this event.
Not every day, but a lot. You know, where are you from?
No, where are you really from?
It happens, and they don't believe that time. I mean, people are just very curious, and I think it's the responsibility of our media to show that we're actually not foreign.
APA Compass, an Asian Pacific American public affairs program. Tune in for features on economic, political, and social justice issues, arts and culture, and APA perspectives.
This time, we look at Cambodian-American communities and the continuing impact of unexploded bombs and mines that the U.S. dropped on Cambodia with the upcoming film premiere, Bomb Hunters. And we'll hear back from Claire Oliveros, who's returned from the International Solidarity Mission in the Philippines. Plus, our interview with comedian, actress, author, and activist, Margaret Cho.
I would really love to be like a straight white man just for a weekend because I think it would be so relaxing.
APA Compass, your Asian Pacific American orientation. Now on first Friday of the month, 9 to 10 a.m.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo de Landeros Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, concern about military recruiting at Portland's Franklin High School. New Orleans endures a housing crisis while tenants organize to defend their rights. And events around the globe commemorate World AIDS Day.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,114 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 42,000 others wounded. Among Iraqi civilians, it's estimated that as many as 30,000 people have been killed as a direct result of the war, while more than 100,000 others have died as a secondary result of the invasion. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 1st, 2005. I'm Marlise Franklin.
And I'm Tom Knipe. Beloved KBOO programmer Ann Rose Pierce has died after a brief illness. Ann was founder of Prison Pipeline, a weekly public affairs show dedicated to advocacy for incarcerated men and women who often called in from the federal penitentiary in Sheridan to talk live on the air. Ann was drawn to this calling after the death of her husband, Greg, who was incarcerated at Sheridan. Greg Lee Pierce died at age 35 in 1996, alone in a prison hospital, chained to a bed with an armed guard outside his door. That led Ann to become an articulate advocate of restorative justice. In 1999, she joined the feminist Bread and Roses Collective at KBOO. After a few months, she split off with a unique program, Prison Pipeline. The show was a watershed for the KBOO community, establishing an unbreakable connection between its many incarcerated fans and the outside world. Chris Merrick, KBOO's program director, said she tore away the iron curtain of censorship between the incarcerated and the outside world.
Tonight at 7 p.m., members of Portland Anti-Military Recruitment Coalition meet to discuss military recruiting at Franklin High School. The event features one teacher and one student from Franklin, as well as a relative of a Franklin alumnus killed in Iraq. With us here in the studio to discuss the event is Abram DeMunoz, right?
DeMunoz.
Thank you for joining us. Tell us, Abram, about the Portland Anti-Military Recruitment Coalition. Who's involved with that?
Well, the PMRs got members from Military Families Speak Out, Veterans for Peace, Code Pink, the Firebrand, War Resisters League, and PCASC. We're a coalition. There's members from each of those groups. And basically, where you've gotten involved with already going on efforts in the city as far as organizing students at their schools.
And what are some of the challenges facing high school students from military recruiters at the moment?
Well, there's a lot of stories, most definitely. A lot of stories of recruiters showing up at the house. On the first day of school this year, we done an action at in various locations in the district in Portland with schools as Madison, Jefferson, Cleveland, and advising students and letting them know about opting out and their deadline with September 30th.
Mm-hmm.
Was their deadline. Basically, that stops, is supposed to stop the military from getting private information on the students and their families.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the other things that you're focusing on at Franklin High School?
Well, focusing on one school, it gives us the assurance that we're achieving in our goals. We're achieving our goals as far as organizing the students, establishing a student organization, and letting them take off with that, you know, like, and from there, we have Madison or Jefferson that we're going to talk about next, and focusing on those schools. So focusing on individual schools and achieving what we're set on, and then moving on from there.
And so, what do you have a specific strategy of how to get in and talk to people in the school?
Well, we speak to teachers that are in social studies, anybody that may be willing to participate. We go along the lines of the rules and regulations of school districts or whatnot, and just basically, you know, a lot of PTA meetings, a lot of parents got involved and go to those and just really want to bring an awareness of how students and children of the working class may be falling prey under the recruiters or military eye.
Thank you, Abram, for being with us in the studio this evening.
Thank you.
That was Abram De Munoz of the Portland Anti-Military Recruitment Coalition, who will be having a meeting this evening at 7 p.m. at Franklin High School.
A report by the City of Portland concluded that Portland General Electric has overcharged ratepayers by nearly $1 billion since it was purchased by energy giant Enron. City Commissioner Randy Leonard, who asked for the review, says he will draft letters to the city attorney and the Multnomah County District Attorney asking for an investigation. In addition to the overcharges, Leonard said PGE has repeatedly said it sent all of the state and federal taxes it collected to Enron. Now the city has learned it kept nearly $100 million. Leonard says PGE officials lied. His comments came after the Willamette Week reported that it had documents indicating that the PGE tax strategy was a deliberate effort to boost revenue and executive bonuses.
A number of organizations here are helping to battle AIDS in one of Portland's nine sister cities, Mutare, Zimbabwe. Clifford Walker is with Oregon Sisters Cities Association. He spoke last week with J.J. Johnson, host of KBOO's show, J.J.'s Place.
What foundation do you have?
Well, actually, it's a sister city association. Portland has nine sister cities, and we're one of the nine, and we're linked to Mutare, Zimbabwe, and that's in Africa.
Okay.
It's about broadening knowledge of the world around us, and for those who are aware of the AIDS pandemic in the world, they know that Africa has been stricken probably most severely. And in our relationship with our brothers and sisters in Africa, we have chosen to go hand in hand with them to fight the war on AIDS, and that's I want to say thank you to all the people in Portland who have joined in that fight, and I want the people to know that the people in Mutare, Zimbabwe, are so thankful for the help that the citizens of Portland are giving them by supplying them with a health clinic.
Okay. Now, how did that come about? Now, by you being in Portland and having a health clinic in Africa, how did you guys connect?
Well, the Sister City Association has been going on probably some 10 years. But I was contacted by a health care worker here in Portland who specializes in HIV AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
Her name was Maria Cosmo. her name is Maria Cosmo Tadas, and she had this idea about, let's see if we can put some music together and raise some money and help the people in our sister city in Mutare, Zimbabwe. And I said, Maria, let's go for it. And it's been a wonderful experience and a tremendous success.
Okay. How long have that clinic been up now in Africa?
Well, the clinic has probably been up a couple years, but the grand opening for the clinic was this past July 15th. And I had the honor of being there when the ribbon was cut. And again, I want you to know that I bring the thanks from the people of Mutare, Zimbabwe, to the people of Portland for helping get that clinic built.
Okay, it's great. What can the people of Portland do to support you or to support the AIDS Foundation? That's what we do here at the Boo, is try to get out to the community, like organizations like yours. I know there's a continued process that's going on. So what are you guys doing right now?
Well, what we have found that works for us is we have a big grand event on World AIDS Day, and World AIDS Day is December 1st of every year.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, December 1st will be Thursday, and we're having our fourth annual benefit concert and dance at the Tiffany Center, and that's on 14th and Morrison Street. And the exciting part, I think, this year is we're bringing the headline. Our program is Earl Thomas, and a lot of people know Earl, and he was a pioneer in music in Portland. And then we have the African Gospel a cappella and the Bonnie Lee Band. So it's going to be a fun thing, and we're mixing fun with this serious challenge of raising money to deal with AIDS. So I hope that people can come down and support the Portland effort in Africa.
That was Clifford Walker speaking with J.J. Johnson. Other organizations sponsoring tonight's event are Africa AIDS Response and AIDS Action Project Northwest. Tom?
Congressmen Earl Blumenauer and Greg Walden plan two public meetings this weekend on the future of Mount Hood and the Columbia Gorge. The lawmakers have proposed legislation in Congress that removes protection for a variety of pristine wilderness areas in both regions. We have on the line Julie Sherman of the Oregon Natural Resources Council to talk about the issue. Julie, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you very much.
Certainly, we know that public testimony is scheduled in Portland and in Hood River on Saturday. Can you briefly bring us up to speed on what's being proposed by Blumenauer and Walden regarding Mount Hood and the Gorge?
Yes, and I wanted to clarify that they're actually proposing legislation to protect a variety of pristine areas. The congressmen are offering the public an opportunity to have a say in the future of Mount Hood and the Columbia Gorge this weekend. What they have actually released so far is a framework for a wilderness bill to protect some portions of the Mount Hood National Forest, including the Columbia Gorge and areas around Mount Hood. The framework is a great start. We're very excited to see a House proposal for wilderness. It's been a long time. We're pleased to see the congressman's bipartisan approach. However, we haven't seen a draft bill or an official map at this time. So, of course, the devil is in the details. The framework that they put forward suggests an initial acreage number of 75,000 acres of new wilderness designations. Oregon Natural Resources Council and several other groups have worked for several years inventorying and mapping roadless areas around the state and looking for areas that qualify as wilderness. And we have found over 260,000 acres of wilderness quality lands within the Mount Hood National Forest and in the Clackamas River drainage. And last year, Senator Wyden introduced a 177,000-acre wilderness bill for the lands around Mount Hood.
So this recommendation is a little smaller in number than the ones that have been talked about earlier.
Yes, absolutely. And really, I know a number like 260,000 is sort of hard to imagine. The 260,000-plus acre proposal is actually very modest. It's less than 0.01% of all the land in Oregon. And it would preserve the last remaining wild roadless lands within the Mount Hood National Forest and in the Clackamas River drainage. To put that in perspective as well, Mount Hood National Forest has over 2,600 clear cuts already. And as we all know, there's a lot of people living around the mountain, living in Portland. Human population continues to expand, so there's continued pressure on these wild areas from that.
Mm-hmm.
And these last best places may not be available to protect if we wait for a long time. So clearly a 75,000-acre bill, while it's a great start, leaves out a lot of these important threatened areas. And if I can, I'd like to mention a few of those to you.
Well, I'd like to ask briefly about the history of the summits. This is actually the third summit held by Blumenauer and Walden, is it not?
It is.
What has come of those previous summits?
Well, this is the first substantive proposal that has come of the summit meetings. Senator Wyden introduced a bill last year that was the 177,000-acre wilderness bill, and that didn't ever move due to political pressures.
I see.
So,
and who's pushing, other than Walden and Blumenauer, for these new wilderness designations?
Well, actually, the pressure is really coming from the public, and there's been a great outpouring of public support from recreation groups around Mount Hood, hunters and fishermen and hikers, campers, just a lot of folks that really love Mount Hood and the Gorge and like to recreate in these areas and would like to see them preserved in their natural state. And obviously, of course, conservation groups as well. ONRC has been working for many years.
And briefly to wrap up, how can the public participate in the summits on Saturday?
The summit meetings are open to the public. They can come to Hood River, Best Western Hood River Inn, from 9 to 11 on Saturday morning. And from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m., they can go to Portland State University's Hoffman Hall. And there will be limited opportunities for speaking, but everyone will be able to turn in any written comments they have. And you can also just go and show your support for wilderness by coming to the meeting, and we'll be there with buttons and pins and that kind of thing.
Okay. Well, thank you, Julie. That was Julie Sherman of the Oregon Natural Resources Council.
On today's segment of Eugene Inform Radio, logging and timber companies will benefit from the new post-fire salvage bills introduced by Oregon's only Republicans in national office, Representative Greg Walden and Senator Gordon Smith. And the Equality Rights Network and Basic Rights Oregon are mobilizing for next year's state legislative elections.
This is Inform Radio, progressive news and community affairs from Eugene, Corvallis, and Southern Cascadia.
This is Amy Merwin. I'm speaking to Jeff Long, who is the project coordinator for the Cascadia Wildlands. Greg Walden, who is Oregon's only Republican in the House of Representatives, introduced a bill that would mandate post-fire cutting of forests.
Walden's bill is titled the Forest Emergency Recovery and Research Act that provides an expedited process for implementation of salvage logging projects following any catastrophic event, which would include fire or natural disasters like drought and insect breakouts. And it would bypass all of the public review process required by the National Environmental Policy Act, and as well as many of the key requirements under the Endangered Species Act, saying that any time a forest burns or experiences a natural disturbance, that it is no longer qualifies as a forest and should be quickly dealt with to, quote-unquote, recover it. Basically, they'll take 30 days to evaluate the area and then essentially go in there, clear-cut, and replant the monocrop. Here's a bill that would last forever. Greg Walden has been joined by Brian Baird of Washington, a Democratic representative, the only Democrat in the West to support this bill. And just this week, Gordon Smith introduced a similar bill into the Senate, which is focused on expediting salvage logging or post-fire logging projects.
Why are these moving ahead?
This topic was really brought to the forefront after the Biscuit Fire in 2002 in Southern Oregon. The timber industry wanted to get in there and log right away. Well, we have environmental protections, we have wilderness acts, we have roadless areas, and we have a public review process that makes that impossible to be pushed through. And once these trees are burned, they slowly start to decay. Conservationists and citizens in Oregon have made it clear that we want to see those nutrients return to the soil. Well, that decay for a timber industry is loss of money. So they see only revenue when they see a fire burn through a forest. So this was something that Gordon Smith and Greg Walden were being urged on by their timber industry donation dollars to their campaigns to get this pushed through.
expectations, planting the seeds for victory in 2006, is a fundraiser being held on December 5th by the Equality Network and Basic Rights Oregon. Here to tell us about the Equality Network is Sally Shecklow.
Equality Network is a LGBTQ, lesbian, gay, bi, trans, queer, and questioning supportive organization that grew out of the passage of Measure 36. We wanted to have our own political action group in Eugene, Springfield that could mobilize and respond quickly and have some influence on how we take care of LGBTQ issues and concerns in our area.
How does Equality Network work in cooperation with Basic Rights Oregon?
It's very collaborative and supportive. This fundraiser on December 5th will generate proceeds that will be split 50-50 between Equality Network and Basic Rights Oregon. Roe Thorpe, who's the executive director of Basic Rights Oregon, will be presenting the plan and strategy for how we're going to take back our state in the name of equality and justice for everyone over the next 3 years. This is kind of the start of the countdown to the elections in 2006. And the intention is very clearly to have a changed legislature in Oregon. For this coming year, the strategy is to identify and support lesbian, gay, bi, trans, queer, friendly candidates and legislators to change how things are done in our legislature.
People are strategizing to have candidates in opposition to Karen Minnis, who's running for her position again.
Karen Minnis, as the Speaker of the House, made it impossible for equal rights measures to even be debated on the floor of the House. She used political maneuvers and the power that we give to our Speaker of the House to send things off to bizarre committees. She would not allow a so-called gay rights measure, which is more a non-discrimination measure that also granted civil union protections and benefits to same-sex couples, even be heard in what she called her chamber. We think that's kind of despotic and not appropriate, and we would really like to have a Democratic Speaker of the House who will at least allow discussion on the floor and allow our legislators to legislate.
People can contact Inform Radio at amy@informproductions.com.
The current time is 5:24. Still to come on the KBOO Evening News, New Orleans endures a housing crisis while tenants organize to defend their rights. Fan Fury prompts Grateful Dead to approve downloads again. And migrant workers susceptible to HIV/AIDS in Thailand. You're listening to Community Radio KBOO in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
Events around the globe are commemorating World AIDS Day today, while in Washington, D.C., President Bush addressed the United States HIV crisis. As FSRN's Darby Hickey reports, those on the front lines of the fight against the epidemic say the U.S. government needs to do more.
After 20 years of being around, also being on, it is an honor that I cut the ribbons while new facility and headquarters at 3636 Georgia Avenue.
Yay! Community activists recommitted to the fight against HIV and AIDS today in Washington, D.C., where the organization Us Helping Us marked the official inauguration of their newly opened building. Us Helping Us is possibly the first group that works to stop HIV in the black gay male community that now owns its own building, which is the latest of many pioneering efforts the agency has led. Executive Director Dr. Ron Simmons says that from the beginning, his organization told people HIV didn't have to be a death sentence.
And basically, we were the only ones giving hope. Whatever else was saying, but it was hopeless. So that was the beginning of Us Helping Us.
Hard work and hope are needed as the HIV epidemic continues to ravage communities, particularly black gay men. Recent federal research in five cities, including nearby Baltimore, estimated the rate of HIV infection among black gay men to be 46%, with a majority of those infected unaware of their status. But Dr. Ron Simmons doesn't see lack of education as the reason for those statistics.
What they're talking about is a childhood trauma. They're still talking about the father calling them a faggot when they were five, and if you're, you know, transgender, God knows what you were called. They still talk about being harassed and bullied in school. you know, being called a sissy and like teachers doing nothing. And they talk about from childhood going to church every single Sunday and being told that, you know, people who have feelings like yours are an abomination in God's sight and you're going to hell. So basically, it's not that they know how to save their lives from HIV, but they don't know that their lives are worth saving.
The Bush administration, of course, promotes abstinence until marriage education as effective HIV prevention, and activists have criticized the president's policies on HIV for the past 5 years. President Bush has also been criticized for not focusing enough on domestic HIV and AIDS issues, a subject he addressed today in a speech at the White House.
At the start of this century, AIDS causes suffering from remote villages of Africa to the heart of America's big cities. This danger is multiplied by indifference and complacency. This danger will be overcome by compassion, honesty, and decisive action.
Federal funding for HIV prevention has been cut in recent years, while money for treatment hasn't been increased. That means hard-to-reach populations who are being affected by HIV are not getting the services they need, says Eliza Jaramillo. Jaramillo is the director of health programs at Casa de Maryland, a Latino service organization just outside D.C. Casa de Maryland released a report today on the state of HIV among Latinos it serves. The findings are representative of problems faced by Latino communities across the country, says Jaramillo.
The main finding is that for Latinos who are seeking information on HIV and AIDS, they don't really know where to go, who to ask for help, and even if they end up at the right place for some reason, they will find that the services are not given in Spanish or that are not culturally sensitive. So the access is limited, and that's why we call it left out.
A report issued earlier this year by a public interest group in Washington, D.C. said the local government is falling far short of its obligation to stop HIV. Mayoral candidate Michael Brown described the grave situation at the Us Helping Us event.
The AIDS rate and treatment in this city rivals developing nations around the world. It's not just one of the worst in America. It's not just one of the worst on the East Coast. In the world, Eastern Africa, Western Africa, we have some issues.
District officials say they are trying to address the problems with local HIV prevention and treatment efforts, including doubling funding for Us Helping Us. Although he's grateful for the monetary support, Dr. Ron Simmons says he's looking to communities to stop the growing rate of infection.
They need to really begin to move this society to one of more enlightenment. Okay, where people are accepted for who they are and are not stigmatized because of it. And to me, community building is a large part of HIV prevention. You've got to build a community. And we need the help of the government and those agencies to help us build this community and really make it work.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C.
I came to Thailand because I can earn more.
The Schwarzenegger administration is recommending that California replace its warehouse-like youth prisons with smaller, more modern lockups. In a court filing yesterday, corrections officials stopped short of recommending that the most notorious youth prisons be closed, as critics have recommended. Judy Campbell has more.
Last November, Governor Schwarzenegger signed a court settlement promising to reform youth corrections, which experts described as violent and inhumane. Now, the administration's plan pledges to reduce the number of youth in each living unit to no more than 38. There are currently up to 80 youth bunked together. The plan doesn't call for the most notorious youth facility to be demolished, which many critics have demanded. Bernard Warner, the new head of juvenile corrections, says the plan emphasizes rehabilitation and reentry programs to lower chances that youth will reoffend upon release.
Right now, we have about one of every three youth receive some kind of treatment service, and this proposal will provide treatment services for the entire youth population that's committed to the state of California.
The reforms call for individual case plans for wards and a new classification system to ensure youth get the proper mental health and rehabilitative treatment. Good ideas, says Don Spector, head of the prison law office, which filed the suit. But he says what was supposed to be a final plan falls far short. It doesn't specify basics like how to implement treatment or who should be in what kind of facility.
They've had a year to classify the prisoners so they can separate them by treatment need and risk of harm, and they haven't done that either. So their commitment to reform has failed to produce results. The governor made a public commitment, and yet his administration has failed to produce.
In last-minute negotiations yesterday, the prison law office and the administration crafted a new legal agreement to hire outside experts who will draw out more detailed reforms by next spring. For the California Report, I'm Judy Campbell.
We have a small correction. The Portland Anti-Military Recruiting Coalition meeting tonight is at Laughing Horse Bookstore. That is at 3652 Southeast Division Street in Portland. We'll leave this information at the front desk if you'd like to call for it later. Some California citizens are rallying on behalf of Crips Gang co-founder and death row inmate Stanley Williams. Actor Jamie Foxx and rapper Snoop Dogg were at one rally in Los Angeles. Williams himself spoke to that crowd via cell phone, saying that he is honored by their support and knows he will be remembered. The rallies coincide with demonstrations around the world for World Cities Against the Death Penalty Day. Williams, also known as Tookie, was convicted of killing four people in 1979 and is scheduled to be executed in 12 days. The rallies in support of the convicted killer turned gang peace activists are a plea for Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger to spare Williams. Schwarzenegger is to meet with prosecutors and lawyers for Williams on December 8th. The California Supreme Court has refused a request by Williams' lawyers to reopen the case.
The University of Kansas has canceled a class intended to debunk creationism and intelligent design after the professor made fun of Christian fundamentalists. In an email posted to a student forum, Professor Paul Marecki wrote that a course depicting intelligent design as mythology would be a, quote, nice slap in their big fat face. The religious studies professor later apologized and said again he was sorry in a statement issued by the university today. Marecki says he made a mistake by not leading by example and discussing differing viewpoints in a civil and respectful manner. 25 students had enrolled in the course scheduled for this spring.
As New Orleans endures a housing crisis caused by the recent devastation, local tenants are organizing for their rights. And with the latest extension on illegal evictions, landlords are increasingly relying on intimidation and extra-legal tactics. Maya Labental reports from New Orleans.
Six residents and 20 activists arrived in the early morning of December 1st to find a newly erected chain-link fence surrounding the Lewisburg Square apartments in the New Orleans suburb of Tarrytown. Supporters came to assure that renters here, who had been subject to repeated intimidation by police and their landlord, did not have their possessions thrown out on the street as threatened. Sonia Collins spoke on her experiences as a Lewisburg Square tenant at a housing rights meeting the previous night.
We have a right to live here. These people try to intimidate us. They call the police, and the police come to in that apartment and try to terrify us. This is one kind of terrorism in this country.
Experiences like Khan's are happening throughout the New Orleans metro area in an environment of increasingly tense relationships between landlords and tenants. Tenant organizer Jeremy Prickett of the New Orleans Housing Emergency Action Team says that he sees telltale signs of illegal eviction every day in the neighborhood that he lives in.
The neighborhood I stay in the Ninth Ward, is on higher ground. And because it's on higher ground, there was no flooding. And because there was no flooding, the units that are left there are very valuable commodities. And I drive through my neighborhood, and I can't drive a block without seeing a pile of furniture and children's toys on the sidewalk. And, you know, it's one thing to see, you know, moldy drywall gutted out of a house, but it's another thing to see children's toys and clothing and all the possessions of some evacuated person, you know, out on the street. And if you want to just count those, man, it's exponential.
This environment is radicalizing residents of New Orleans. Jessica Matthews lives in the Bywater neighborhood and says that her landlord attempted to illegally evict her. She is now an activist with no heat.
You know, when my landlord first told me to leave, I really had no idea what to do, but I started looking around and I found that there was help available. And, you know, there are coalitions that are developing that offer help. And now that it seems like I've at least got my place for a month, I'm trying to sort of help out with that. Every time somebody goes through this and actually fights it, and learns, you know, what they can do. I think it just makes it easier for each next person who comes along. And people should definitely try and fight this if possible, because they don't have to bow to the whims of their landlords.
Many evacuees are finding that locating affordable housing is a major barrier for them to come back to New Orleans. Rose Harrison, a public housing resident, spoke at a Mass Tenants' Rights meeting hosted Tuesday night in a New Orleans church about her difficulties coming back to the city.
My house was destroyed. I lost a brother, a nephew, and a sister-in-law during Hurricane Katrina. I want to come back home. This is home. I don't like nothing about Dallas at all. It's too big. I don't know how to get around. I get lost. I cry, and I be trying to get back home. But my point is, I want to come home, but where can I live? My grandchildren want to come back home, but there is no schools open. What do we do? What can we do? I need some answers, and I need them ASAP.
New Orleans evacuees are experiencing housing problems in other cities as well. 52 families were recently evicted from a Houston housing complex in November, and a similar eviction is taking place in Berkeley, California. Tenants' rights activists are concerned that unless evacuees are provided with affordable housing here and in other cities, that the New Orleans diaspora may become a problem of mass homelessness. Jeremy Prickett of No Heat says that he expects the rate of evictions in New Orleans to increase after the holidays, as landlords do not want to be seen as evicting their tenants this time of year. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Maya Beliebenthal with Christian Roseland.
The trial of Sami Al-Aryan has drawn intermittent national and international attention. A professor at the University of South Florida, Al-Aryan was arrested in 2003 and charged with providing material support to the Palestinian Islamic Jihad under the cover of various charities. Yet, after nearly 6 months, the prosecution has failed to prove that the money was sent for any purpose other than charity. U.S. attorneys have denied that they are pursuing Al-Aryan along with three other defendants for political reasons, but many say the government's case is built on unsubstantiated allegations. FSRN's Lance Robson files this report from Tampa.
Sami Al-Aryan is a Palestinian rights activist who first became associated with members of the Islamic Jihad movement during the first Palestinian uprising in the late 80s. He is also a career academic that founded mosques, ran charities, co-founded an Islamic issues think tank, and lobbied Congress on the issue of secret evidence. All of Al-Aryan's activities have been raised in this case, but the prosecution has particularly focused on the academic think tank, as well as the charitable goods and monies sent to needy Palestinians, alleging that these activities benefited the Islamic Jihad movement alone. Investigative journalist John Sugg has followed the story since 1994, when Al-Aryan was questioned about his personal and political associations. John Sugg.
Sami always said that he and the people he was closest to had taken positions contrary to when the Islamic Jihad became violent. And he reiterated that when I talked to him last week. He said, look, you know, after a certain date in 1994, you find no phone conversations dealing with the Islamic Jihad.
In late 1995, the media spotlight was turned on Al-Aryan when one of his associates at the academic think tank, Ramadan Shallah, left America to head the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. According to defense attorneys, the working relationship Al-Aryan had with Ramadan Shallah, as well as Shallah's subsequent actions in the Middle East, have been unfairly used to define Sami Al-Aryan's politics. Bill Moffitt, Al-Aryan's lead attorney, has repeatedly said that the trial is a political one that deals with freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and the right to practice one's own religion. After his closing statements, Moffitt spoke to the press about the distinction between the government's allegations of criminal activity and Al-Aryan's activism on behalf of the Palestinian people.
I think it's important that we remain a place where people who feel that they're being abused and suffering can come and discuss their suffering in an open and a fair forum without fear that they're going to be prosecuted. I think if you go through the tapes, I think you can take that period of time, that 1994-1995 period, and you can look at what Sami Al-Aryan did and look at Shallah did, and you can see the difference.
Since his arrest in 2003, a group of ministers has rallied around Al-Aryan in support. In a press conference, Dwight Lawton, a Bay Area Presbyterian minister, raised key questions he believes are central to the case.
Why was Dr. Al-Aryan placed in solitary confinement for 2 years and subject to harsh treatment that Amnesty International has condemned? Why was Dr. Al-Aryan fired from his position on the faculty of the University of South Florida without due process? Why has there been a continual questioning of Arab Muslims that appears to have the effect of silencing the Arab Muslim community so as to preclude their support and attendance at Dr. Alarian's trial.
Nahla Alarian echoed the views of friends and supporters when she spoke about the government's motivation in pursuing her husband and his activities.
The government targeted him because he was defending the Palestinian cause and he was effective. He also managed to mobilize the Muslim community to go and be part of the American society, to be part of the political process. And there are some people here who don't want to see that. They want the American Muslims to be marginalized.
After a six-month trial, the jury has been deliberating an adjusted 51-count indictment for nearly 2 weeks now, and it is uncertain when a verdict will be handed down. For Free Speech Radio News in Tampa, I'm Lance Robson.
Grateful Dead fans are free to share shows online again. The band has reversed course and is again allowing downloads of recording of its live concerts. Last week, the Dead angered fans by asking a nonprofit website to stop making the recordings available. Band spokesman Dennis McNally says the group was influenced by the backlash from fans who for decades have freely taped and traded live performances. McNally says the Dead's in favor of tape trading. However, live recordings made directly from concert soundboards will only be made available for listening, not downloading, from now on. They're the band's legal property, and McNally says the Dead's legal rights need to be protected. The site Internet Archive has reposted recordings of concerts.
The current time is 5:42, and now daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The results are in, and we have a winner. The Emmy Award for the most pathetic performance on live television goes to Senator Chuck Grassley, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, for his role in the recent hearing on price gouging by Big Oil. He was ably aided by the CEOs of ExxonMobil, Chevron, Texaco, ConocoPhillips, Shell, and BP, who sat before Grassley's committee like toads on a log, refusing to budge when prodded about some $100 billion in windfall profits they've run up in just the past few months. "We do not see this as a windfall," said the honcho of ConocoPhillips, even though his company siphoned off nearly $4 billion in profits in three summer months alone, a 90% jump over the previous year. Did Grassley gavel these arrogant toads into silence and assert his senatorial responsibility to protect the public? Maybe by pushing a windfall profits tax to recoup some of what the oil giants have ripped out of our wallets? Oh, dear, no. That would be, well, senatorial. Instead, Grassley begged. In essence, this powerful U.S. senator shook a tin cup at the CEOs, asking them to make a charitable contribution to help poor people pay their heating bills this winter. "You have a responsibility to help less fortunate Americans to cope with the high cost of heating fuels," he pleaded, asking them to donate a mere 10% of their third quarter profits. The toads declined to give. "Excuse me, Chuck, but making sure that vulnerable, very low-income Americans have heat in winter is not a matter of charitable corporate whim, but of public responsibility. Instead of groveling pathetically, tax the windfall profits of these incomparably rich oil giants to fully fund the $3 billion shortfall in the government's low-income heating program." This is Jim Hightower saying, government has a duty to serve the public interest, even if it means confronting corporate gougers. Support for this program comes from The Progressive Magazine, featuring columnists Miley Ivins, Howard Zinn, and Barbara Ehrenreich, with features and information available at progressive.org.
Stay tuned for independent Native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear Proverbial Perspectives with Shahid Hamid. The topic is transition from incarceration to freedom with the African American program. At 7, it's Good Times with Reggae Bob. Tonight's weather, rain showers with a low of 35, and tomorrow more rain showers with a high of about 43. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Each year, thousands of migrant workers arrive in Thailand from neighboring Cambodia, Laos, and Burma in search of economic stability. Along with cross-border movement and introduction to a new environment, there's also an increased vulnerability to HIV/AIDS. FSRN's Kathy Hong and Kai Mesa Barnard report from Thailand.
I came to Thailand because I can earn more. In Thailand, I can earn more money.
Burmese fisherman Mayao is one of nearly 1.3 million registered migrant workers in Thailand. They've come to this country seeking a better life and more economic opportunities. However, the reality is that life as a migrant poses its own difficulties. Besides hard and low-paying labor, migrants must also deal with isolation from their home community and loved ones. In her work with the international aid agency World Vision, Dr. Egan provides support to migrant fishermen who endure some of the most demanding hours and often turn to alternate means of companionship.
They have to do a lot of hard work, and they have to stay in the sea for a long time, sometimes about 1 or 2 months. They have no recreation at all on the boat. So when they come to the shore, they go and visit karaoke shops. They go and find sex services like that. They have no other recreation because they cannot go out in the town area.
This combination of hard and dangerous work, separation from family and community, and restrictions on their activities make migrants highly vulnerable to the spread of HIV/AIDS. The increased risk migrants face is augmented by a lack of education and awareness on the disease and its transfer. Jackie Pollock, coordinator of the Migrant Assistance Program in Northern Thailand, notes that the educational situation in neighboring Burma, the source country of the majority of migrant laborers in Thailand, plays a role in the spread of HIV/AIDS.
Migrants coming from Burma have no knowledge of HIV/AIDS at all. They have not had any information whatsoever in Burma, and so they come to Thailand not knowing. Meanwhile, Thailand has been giving out information for the last 20 years, so they almost come into a position where they're getting the advanced course in HIV, so it's quite difficult to get that information to really start from step one again, so that people just get the very basics of what is HIV/AIDS, how is it transmitted, how do you protect.
In order to address the deficits in HIV-related knowledge, the Thai government and non-governmental organizations are working together to raise awareness and provide peer education in migrant communities. Programs promoting condom usage and community building are offered in native languages by community members. Because migration law currently restricts employment to certain low or unskilled work, Pollock emphasizes the need for changes to allow migrants to deliver these services.
So we've been asking that there should be a special clause added that migrants can be employed to work as health workers, because otherwise there's no way to do this work, because the Thai population doesn't speak Burmese or Shan or Karen, so it has to be done by the migrants themselves.
Tusnai Kintayaporn, a representative from NGO Coalition Prevention of HIV/AIDS Among Migrant Workers in Thailand, reveals the progress in working with the government in this area.
If you don't use the people from the same community to educate their people, then you will fail in control any kind of disease. And then the community understand this. And now they are, even though now they don't directly provide the legal status for the outreach work, migrant outreach worker, but they allow them to work as a so-called full-time volunteer.
Ultimately, the goal is to provide a supportive and familiar environment for migrants to help reduce their vulnerability to HIV/AIDS.
You know, once you are away from your home country, you always find a place where there is you feel home. Yes, they are looking for somebody who understands them, and then we offer them with this first, and after them, yes, education and message came later.
This is Kathy Hong with Kai Mesa Barnard for FSRN in Thailand.
The legal framework of the Kyoto Protocol has been formally adopted by the ongoing United Nations Conference to determine the future of the environmental treaty. For Free Speech Radio News, Elise Huygus reports from Montreal.
The Kyoto Protocol has now become legally binding after parties to the treaty formally approved the agreement yesterday in Montreal. The treaty aims to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to below 1990 levels. Some environmentalists say this target is too low to combat the effects of global warming, which could result in rising ocean levels, irregular weather, drought, and famine. Ratified by 55% of the world's nations last February, many countries have been unable to meet their commitments without a legal mechanism to enforce the standards. As the UN negotiations continue until December 9th, environmental groups are holding parallel events in Montreal to highlight the responsibility of citizens in combating climate change. They say that poor people will pay the highest cost of the effects of global warming, signaling the recent Gulf Coast hurricanes and last December's tsunami. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Elise Hugues in Montreal.
Two Coca-Cola bottling plants in India are facing stiff opposition from locals who say the company is depleting local water resources. Binu Alex has more from Ahmedabad.
Hundreds marched yesterday in northern India to protest a local Coca-Cola bottling plant they say is damaging the local environment. This as the Kerala government in southern India has ruled that a Coca-Cola plant in Palachimada must obtain special clearance to draw groundwater. Local campaigners say the Palachimada plant may well face a permanent closure after the government declared the area's water resources overexploited. The plant, India's largest, has attracted widespread criticism after the local village governing council cancelled Coke's license in response to complaints of depleting groundwater resources. Even a legal battle could not revive the plant, which has since been out of operation for over a year and a half. Activists in Kerala are now planning to initiate criminal culpability and liability cases against Coca-Cola for the destruction of lives, livelihood, public health and the environment. From Ahmedabad in India, I'm Benu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
Nearly 3 weeks after the explosion of a chemical plant that polluted a major river in northern China, local authorities are asking for help to cope with the public health and environmental implications. FSRN's Severine Bardot reports from Beijing.
The 50-mile-long leak of toxic benzene that polluted the Songhua River after the November 13th explosion of a petrochemical plant has now poured into the Heilong River and is expected to reach the Russian city of Khabarov in about 10 days. After a formal apology to Russia last weekend, Chinese authorities are now offering the neighboring country monitoring equipment and help to train Russian personnel in dealing with the massive pollution. China has requested an international scientific team composed of World Health Organization and United Nations Development Programme members to evaluate the situation in Harbin. Their task will be to provide technical expertise in the area of water and chemical contamination, as well as to study the public health implications, according to a WHO spokesperson in Beijing. Scientists estimate that 70 more cities and about a million people will be affected by the toxic spill downstream in Russia. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Severine Bardon in Beijing.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 1st, 2005. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM, on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer and engineer for tonight's newscast is Jamie Heim. Tonight's audio editor is Michael Newman. Special thanks to reporter J.J. Johnson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Tom Knipe.
And I'm Marlise Franklin. Coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. And at 7:30 a.m., hear Positively Revolting Talk Radio with Ani and Melody, who focus on the Portland Police with their guest Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch. At 9, it's APA Compass, featuring an interview with actress, author, and activist Margaret Cho. Also hear about global issues affecting Asian and Pacific Islander communities. At 10, Per Foggering interviews Captain James Yee, the former U.S. Army Muslim chaplain at Guantanamo Bay, and author of For God and Country, Patriotism Under Fire. At 10:30, Sounds of Awareness. The topic is Help for Menorrhagia, or Severe Menstrual Symptoms. At 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. That's all right here on KBOO, your community, nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored radio station. Thanks for joining us tonight.
This is
Independent Native News for Thursday, the 1st of December. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. In South Dakota, business owners, ranchers, and local residents are meeting to try and stop a new concert venue from opening near Bear Butte, which is considered a sacred site for Native Americans in the area. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Francis Lynn has details.
The Bear Butte International Alliance, made up of Lakota, Dakota, and Cheyenne tribal members, as well as interested members of the community, are inviting the public to discuss the need for respectful development around what many consider to be a sacred site. Nancy Kyle, a member of the group, believes that fast economic development for a few is being placed above the quality of life for all Sturgis citizens.
When respect for your neighbors and respect for the earth, respect for your community are being degraded, then you have to stop and take a look. And Sturgis has a very diverse community. Some voices aren't being heard.
Kyle says the group wants to see a ban on any new development for 5 miles around the site and a 7-mile buffer zone against any new liquor licenses. The group was galvanized into action after plans for a large concert venue just outside Bear Butte were unveiled. The Arizona-based developer Jay Allens has said he wants to create positive growth in harmony with the community and landscape. But members of the Bear Butte International Alliance believe any further encroachment, especially ones involving alcohol, will disrupt the silence necessary for meditative prayer. The next outreach meeting will take place on December 16th in Sturgis. For Independent Native News, I'm Frances Lynn.
$15 million in federal money is available to tribes in the West. As Ellen Churchak reports, the money is intended to improve environmental conditions on reservations.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has a special division that deals exclusively with tribes, the American Indian Environmental Program. The EPA recognizes the sovereignty of tribes, which is why it has this special department. The EPA helps tribes with environmental issues and also steps in to do enforcement. But Jean Gamache with the EPA says the agency also offers millions of dollars in grants to tribes in 9 different regions to help keep their reservations clean.
The partnership that the agency has been able to create with federally recognized tribes has been an important one. We have been able to achieve some real accomplishments. We've been able to make an environmental difference.
The grants can be used for things like improving access to safe drinking water or building infrastructure to deal with safe disposal of wastewater and sewage. California, Nevada, and Arizona, which make up one region, are eligible for $15 million in Indian Environmental General Assistance grants. I'm Ellen Churchak in Sacramento.
As part of the festivities for November's Native American Month, the University of Iowa highlighted the importance of powwows for preserving tribal culture and history. Pat Blank has the story.
Dean Whitebreast is a member of the Sac and Fox tribe of the Mississippi of Iowa, also known as the Meskwaki. He believes Native American ceremonial dances link performers to their heritage.
When you do dress up, put on your regalia and get out there, you have flashbacks, perhaps, of your dad or your grandma or your grandpa, and it provides a good feeling for you that you're doing something to carry on what they have taught you.
Whitebreast explains that there are several types of dances, ranging from the slow, purposeful memorial or honor dance to the fast-paced and spectacular fancy feather dance. He says in his tribe, children are introduced to the traditions as toddlers.
Even at a young age, they know what they have to maintain as far as our heritage and our tribal traditions and our culture and everything that goes along with that. They realize that even at an early age that they must continue it.
Dean Whitebreast is a member of the Sac and Fox tribe of the Mississippi of Iowa, also known as the Meskwaki. His presentation is part of UNI's celebration of Native American Heritage Month. Throughout this report, we've been hearing the sounds of dance performers from the Haskell Indian Nation of Lawrence, Kansas, who performed on campus. Reporting from Cedar Falls, Iowa, this is Pat Blank.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Indian Country's e-edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com.